This is Guardian Radio, your station for up-to-the-minute news, intelligent, interactive, and engaging conversation. 96.9 FM. The views and opinions of the hosts and guests are their own and do not necessarily reflect the position of the management and staff of Guardian Network.
And welcome to the Doctor's Inn with me, Dr. Dinothra Archer Cartwright. Welcome to another exciting show for all things health, wellness, and things that pertain to the Bahamian society. Welcome to the show. Good night, everybody. We're brought to you by Medical Concierge Services for all your medical health needs. We're located on Collins Avenue, number 72, 326-1521. Now, producer, the last time I was made the host, they said that they couldn't hear on the radio side. So let's just make sure that everyone is hearing us out there on 96.9 Guardian Radio. You can hear us live on Facebook. The Doctor is in with me, Dr. D. Archer, and also, of course, Guardian Talk Radio .com. You can check it out there as well. And we're live on air. So last week we were covering a doctor from the World Health Council that was actually calling for the vaccine to be stopped completely. We've had also a couple of different countries that have stopped the program for children. And so we're gonna continue with that presentation tonight because I really want everybody to hear. I'm gonna see if I can play it here. If not, we'll let the producer play the video. But we've known that there was problems with AstraZeneca that was basically taken out of most people's lineup. But then we had quite a few of the European countries that stopped vaccinating children under 12 and most recently under 17. And some of the countries that are doing some banning of some of the use are countries like Italy, France, Germany. And we've seen bans in a lot of those countries. And so this interestingly continues. Now we've had our first weekend without having a mask mandate in place for most areas. And I saw a mixture of things. I saw a mixture of people wearing a mask, people not wearing a mask. So it was quite interesting to see what people were choosing to do. But the whole point is that people do have choices, choices from now on to kind of decide for themselves. And we saw the Minister of Health basically say she was hoping that this would end for children. So we're hoping the best too, that it will end for children. And we're gonna kind of go from there. And so I hope that will pretty much end most of the issues, because the restrictions coming into the country are basically just about gone. So we're gonna try to play the rest of the Good Doctor's video tonight, just to kind of end this series. But it's Dr. Asim Malhotra, and he had done a new peer review paper which calls for the immediate and complete ending of this entire process of pushing the vaccine and looking at some of the things that are going on. So I'm going to try to play it. Producer, if it doesn't work, I think you will have to play it. So we're going to kind of go from where he was. I'm not sure where we were last time, but at about 40 minutes, he really kind of gets into the meat of his initiative. Okay, so I'm not sure if you're hearing that. If you're not hearing that, then I'm going to need you to play it, Mr. Producer. So that was just Dr. Asim basically going over some of the points from the previous first half of the video, which was just suggesting that, you know, we have to go back to this idea of informed consent. It is one of the roots of things that are important with medicine, and that if people have all the facts, you tend to have people who are less medicated when they kind of understand and what they want and what's going on, and they have the type of information, we have a little less medicated society rather than just maybe accepting all of the drugs that they are placed on. There are some drugs that are extremely important, but a part of having a patient-centered approach to medicine allows the patient to really be a part of that conversation. And what you have is less drugs. We talked about the following week that the drug and pharmaceutical corporations have really become an embedded part of how medicine is actually performed. And that's led to kind of a different path than originally we thought we would get with evidence-based medicine. So producer, if you could play the video, just let me know when you're ready.
Health Organization Bulletin, 2009. It is an ethical imperative that every doctor and patient understand the difference between absolute and relative risks to protect patients against unnecessary anxiety and manipulation. In other words, I would say it is unethical or ethically dubious to not explain to patients when it comes to drug treatment what the absolute benefits and the harms of the drug are. And then I published another paper with the chair of the medical college, Sue Bailey, to say that, listen, this needs to be part of medical training, because actually, interestingly, when you look at data and you present information to patients in this way, one, it doesn't cause worse outcomes. They tend to use less treatment. Patients tend to opt for informed consent to have less drugs, less interventions, less surgery. So they're less likely to get harmed, and they're more empowered, they feel more satisfied. That's what we should be doing, and it'll probably save a lot of money in the NHS. Okay. Let's get to the chase, all right? So, the COVID mRNA vaccines. So why was I willfully blind? I was one of the first people to have the COVID-19 vaccine. In January 2021, I helped out in a vaccine center and had the leftovers because, as you know, the first of the high-risk people were taking the vaccine. There was a couple of personal reasons. One was my dad was very worried. We'd lost my mom a few years earlier. He was very worried and fearful of COVID, like many people were. And he was worried that I was going to get COVID and whatever else. So he was on my case. Please come and have, you know, we can get you, get the vaccine, help in the vaccine center, blah, blah, blah. That was one of the reasons. The other reasons was that I, at the time, did not even conceive, and I can tell you this is still a problem right now, this very moment, and I've spoken to doctors recently who still have this issue. I did not conceive of the possibility that a vaccine could cause any real harm at all. It wasn't even part of, it wasn't even anywhere in my brain. It wasn't, you know, I wouldn't even go there. You know, I was getting sent stuff, which I considered at the time, and by the way, some of it may well be this, and excuse me for these terms, but I was being sent at the time stuff that I considered complete anti-vax nonsense. One of my friends is Gurinder Chadha, the film director. You may know of her, Bend It Like Beckham, Blinded by the Light. And she comes to me for medical advice all the time. And she was saying to me, Aseem, you know, I'm getting all this stuff. And I said, Gurinder, this is just complete nonsense. I said, and I still believe this to be true, by the way, when you look at traditional vaccines compared to all the other drugs we prescribe, they are probably one of the safest, and that is still true. And therefore, and I didn't come and sort of point fingers and say these people are loons or anything like that. Good Morning Britain, she tweeted out, I've had the vaccine because Dr. Malhotra convinced me, sent me some information. And then I went on Good Morning Britain, and they said, what's going on with vaccine hesitancy? I said, we have to understand where this is coming from because we know the history of the drug industry. But I said, still, vaccines are some of the safest in the history of medicine. Next slide, please. And just to, you know, reemphasize that, now I know there's still a controversy and some people have got, you know, issues around other things like MMR, et cetera, but we're not, this is not part of the discussion. And if you look at the World Health Organization and you look at the data, and I've looked at this quite carefully, you know, vaccines still are probably one of modern medicine's, not all vaccines necessarily, but they have contributed considerably to improving life expectancy and probably, you know, save around 4 to 5 million lives a year according to the WHO. So that, I'm saying this is because that is also, that was my mindset, that still is my mindset when it comes to traditional vaccines. So what happened? Well, over a few months, conversations with various people started to make me think a little bit differently. So one of the people that I consider, and I won't name him, he's one of the brightest cardiologists in the country, very high scientific integrity. I worked with him, I've published with him, a bit younger than me, and he came to me, and he works in a cardiac center, he's an interventional cardiologist, and he said, Aseem, I just want to tell you something. I said, I've not had the, I met him in sort of April last year. He said, I've not had the vaccine. And I said, really? And he's a very smart guy. I mean, he publishes for fun. You know, he can take papers apart. And he said, there's something, one, I'm a bit uncertain about this new technology, which I didn't know about at the time. And he said, the other thing is, I'm low risk. And he was right. He understood that he was low risk, late 30s. He's low risk of COVID. But he said, the other thing that really concerned him, he said, the supplementary appendix of the original Pfizer trial that led to the approval of the drug, he said, I'm hoping this is not a true, this is erroneous, this may be just a coincidence, but he said there were 4 cardiac arrests in the vaccine group and 1 in the placebo. And he said, that concerns me. I said, okay, fine. And I kind of listened to him, but I carried on, you know. And then what happened after that is my father suffered a sudden cardiac arrest in July last year. Many of you may know of this. It was quite a harrowing experience. My dad was my best friend, last surviving member of my immediate family. I'm a cardiologist. His lifestyle was great, he was very healthy. And it was very shocking to everybody in the community because this guy was super fit, you know. I ruptured my Achilles. I was a badminton champion in Manchester School's badminton champion. After my mum's death, we were spending more time together. We played badminton for the first time in about 20 years. And I'm pretty fit. I'm not just, you know, I'm very, you know, into my fitness. And my 72-year-old dad took me to almost an hour into a badminton match where we could barely breathe. He beat me for the first time in the first game. And I ruptured my Achilles. And part of me was proud that my dad was still, it was that fit that he was able to do that. That was only 2 years ago. So all of it didn't make sense. Got a post-mortem done on him. Didn't make sense to me. You know, I'm a cardiologist that does a lot of research and understands how coronary disease develops, how it progresses. I know this in a lot of detail. He had 2 critical narrowings in his arteries. And we knew he had heart scans a few years earlier. He didn't have anything significant. His lifestyle, in fact, had got better since then. Didn't make any sense. And I just thought, what was this? Was it stress? What was it? I couldn't explain it. And then a number of things happened. Sorry, just come back. A number of things happened and simultaneously, which I know this got a lot of attention at the time. And I had to, so I got contacted by a whistleblower in a very prestigious.
Yeah. So really interesting stuff there. So this is Dr. Aseem, and he basically talks about how initially he really didn't understand hesitancy, even though he's a guy who's done a lot of research and everything like that. And his dad kind of convinced him, you need to go and get vaccinated. He did that. His father was very healthy. After he had spoken to another friend of his who was also a cardiologist who did a lot of research, he said he was not taking the vaccine because of looking at the data out of the Pfizer trials. He saw that the persons who had been vaccinated had four episodes of cardiac issues compared to one in the placebo group, which is the placebo group are those who did not take the medication. So the group that had taken the vaccination, they had four persons that got a cardiac arrest or a cardiac issue versus the one in those who didn't. And he thought that was abnormal, being a cardiologist who did research. And he said, you know, I'm just going to hold out. And he did a risk-based assessment of himself and decided that, you know, it just wasn't worth it. And this was one of the first things that had this doctor kind of enlightened to the fact that maybe there was something wrong. The second point that came up is after realizing this and starting to do his own research, his father had a massive heart attack, who was a very, very healthy man and had no real issues prior to this. And this is where Dr. Seem really starts to have a change of heart on everything and leads him to doing all of the research that we talked about. We've got a comment online from Dr. Comer. It says, great topic. A relative risk is what was used to promote the efficacy of the mRNA shot as opposed to absolute relative risk. That is correct. And so he talks about this. If you watch the full clip, which I will put on my Facebook page, if you want to watch the full thing, because there's another part of this that talks about kind of the pathology of all of this. But that part will be super boring on the radio. So I'll let you guys, you can continue, producer, from there where he goes on with this.
This very prestigious British institution, I won't name it, but let's say it's one of the most in the world, prestigious institutions. And he told me that there is a group of researchers, cardiologists in this department, who had actually accidentally found, through use of coronary imaging, that in vaccinated versus unvaccinated, there was a huge signal of coronary inflammation related to the mRNA vaccine. And they had a meeting, and they said, we're not going to publish these findings because it may threaten our funding from the drug industry. Now, after I did this GB News interview, he then informed me, because obviously they saw it, someone saw it, non-disclosure agreements were sent out to several of these people. Now this, yeah, and I trust this person. Of course, I can't produce the exact evidence here, but let's just say I implicitly trust this person. There's no reason for him to lie about it. Where was this replicated anyway independently with people that didn't know each other? Yes, so Stephen Gundry published an abstract in Circulation, and what he found, and this is very interesting, this really concerned me, is that within about 8 weeks of people having the mRNA vaccine and people he was following up in their middle age, there was a massive increase of coronary inflammatory markers that increased risk of heart attacks from 11% at 5 years to 25%, which I can tell you is a massive increase. Now, what does that tell you if this is true, and it likely has some legitimacy, certainly with the data I'm going to show you now? It means that the mRNA vaccine could be accelerating coronary artery disease. So let's say you're due to have a heart attack, you know, you don't know about this, you're going to have a heart attack in 10 years, you suddenly might be having a heart attack in 1 year. So it's going to accelerate coronary disease. That's one of the things. And data was coming, and I got contacted by a journalist saying, we've got this unexplained increase in heart attacks in different hospitals. So I went on GB News, and I thought, okay. And of course, then I thought about my dad. And I thought, listen, now I need to look at this in detail. Let me try and use evidence-based medicine. Let's look at the data properly. Let's look at absolute risk reduction. Let me look at where the harms are. Let me look in places I'd never even gone to before. And that's what, obviously, you know, the paper explains in detail. So the first thing is, well, what did the... So we talk about absolute risk reduction. And I think we can... One of the reasons I didn't really look into this in detail at the beginning is I was under the impression the vaccine would prevent transmission. So the numbers, you know, it was difficult how many people would benefit, because I thought, well, actually, in the population, a vaccine that's relatively safe, if you give it and it prevents infection, even if it's 1% of people initially, it's going to have a knock-on effect and it's going to protect many more people. We obviously now know that's completely false. That isn't true. We don't even know if it was true at the beginning. But we broke down, looked at the actual data, and the original trial that led to the approval of the drug that people weren't having discussions, informed discussions about, revealed you had to vaccinate 119 people to prevent one person from being infected with COVID-19, the original Wuhan strain. Something else I only found a few months ago, which shocked me, and this is there from the FDA. So one of the things that happened shortly after both me and my dad had the vaccine, we got sent, Public Health England, it was Public Health England at the time, sent out some free antibody tests, and they wanted us to reply to what our, you know, pinprick and the finger, have you got antibodies? I was actually elated. I was like, ah, the vaccine works. I tweeted it out because it was antibody positive. Is it of any use? Doesn't appear to be, not according to the FDA. In May last year, the FDA, and you can look this up, the FDA is reminding the public and healthcare providers that results from currently authorized SARS-CoV-2 antibody tests should not be used to evaluate a person's level of immunity or protection from COVID-19 at any time, and especially after the person has received a COVID-19 vaccination. Why was this not publicized all across the news? We're currently, we've got these new Omicron variant vaccines that have been tested on 8 mice that are using a pure surrogate of antibodies, which we don't know has any benefit whatsoever with no clinical outcome data. This is a miscarriage of medical science. This is complete and total nonsense. So what about, okay, so let's just accept, okay, doesn't have a great effect on infection, but of course the narrative changed. It's not gonna prevent you getting infected, but it'll prevent you from serious illness and death. So actually working with Claire, who I've acknowledged in the paper, Claire and the Heart Group, what we decided to do, I asked Claire to look into this, is there some way from real world data, not a modeling study, not extrapolations, real world data from hospital admissions in the UK to calculate what the numbers needed to treat would be or vaccinate would be to prevent a COVID death. Now, during the Delta wave, just going to the next slide, we were able to actually look at different age groups because UKHSA had that data. We had data on hospitalizations and death, actually, for per 100,000 vaccinated versus unvaccinated. Great, this is interesting. Now, there are problems with this data in the sense you don't correct for confounding factors. So for example, as Carl Hennigan has pointed out, Director of Center of Evidence-Based Medicine, some of his patients that died from COVID-19 who were unvaccinated were terminally ill, and they decided they weren't gonna have the vaccine. So this isn't corrected for that, but so it actually probably is an exaggeration of benefit. But if you look at the Delta wave, and I'm gonna give you some figures here. If you look at the Delta wave, so this is the bottom slide here, looking at last year, the whole wave, 4 months, is if you look at people over 80, so we're able to separate it by age group. So you have to vaccinate 230 people over the age of 80 to prevent one COVID death. 520 if you're 70 to 79, 1300 if you're 60 to 69, 2600 if you're 50 to 59. Next slide, please. What about Omicron? I did put this in the paper. We only had about 3 months of data earlier this year, but this is pretty extraordinary stuff again. Omicron. How useful is the vaccine or the traditional vaccine we've been using to prevent a COVID death from Omicron, according to real world data? If you're over 80, you've got to vaccinate 7,300 people to prevent one COVID death. 17,000 next decade younger. 30,000, 63,000, 167,000. This is the absolute.
So 167,000 in the younger age group to possibly prevent one death, 163,000. For a population of ours, which is about 400,000 people, we would basically have to vaccinate everybody in the country for the possibility of maybe, you know, affecting two persons. And that's what he's saying here, that when they looked at the real world data beyond the initial studies and what was happening in the real world with various different variants, the efficacy was really, really poor. Comment again from online, 119 people to vaccinate to prevent infection per person. Is this correct? We would need to vaccinate 350,000 persons to prevent 3K persons from being infected. No, it's even, yeah, lower than that. So our entire population to prevent one infection. Yeah, our entire population, probably two deaths, if that's even correct. So that's a very, very, very low threshold. And you have to think about then when you were to vaccinate this 350,000 people to possibly at some point save maybe two people, possibly, not even definitely, what side effects would you see in that population with a drug that indeed has over 1,200 possible side effects? And so just if one person got one of each one of those side effects, that would be 1,200 people versus possibility of saving two people. So as you can see, the risk-based analysis on that is not working out very well in the real world scenario. And it's getting worse as we go into various variants, because as we know, the initial drug was made for the initial wild type, and that really hasn't, that's changed a lot since then. So you're kind of using something that's obsolete in the sense, even if there was some initial benefit, it's definitely not there now. You can go on, producer. You can just continue.
Absolute benefit in preventing a COVID death, probably best case scenario. Now, there's something else that's important to note. The original trial, randomized controlled trial, which is supposed to correct for everything, quite a large trial, about 40,000 people, done by Pfizer and even Moderna, did not show any statistically significant reduction in COVID death. Now, for me, and there may be lots of reasons for that, it's something to think about because it makes you wonder, hold on a minute. The gold standard trial didn't show any statistically significant reduction. Now, the argument could be it wasn't powered, it wasn't enough people, but if 40,000 people wasn't enough to show statistically significant reduction in death, it means the benefit in reducing death is probably very, very small. It's not non-existent, but it's tiny. And we come back to shared decision-making. Who was told about this? Were any of you told this? No. That's where we need to move forward. We need to look at this in a bit more granular way. Okay, next slide. One of the other issues as well to mention briefly, which probably won't surprise you, when I spoke to the chair of the BMA, I mean, it's interesting. I said, you know, he said, Asim, I think most of my colleagues, and this is historical as well, and it may surprise you, many people in health policy actually make their decisions on media stories. So the media reporting on it. He said to me, I think a lot of my colleagues are getting information on the benefits and harms of the vaccine from the BBC. And we know that media storing is not, media reporting isn't very accurate. This was published in JAMA Internal Medicine a few years ago, looking at US, how accurate were health stories in terms of explaining the actual benefits or harms or whatever an intervention. And a 5 of 10 review criteria were basically unsatisfactory. Costs, benefits, harms, absolute risks and benefits, quality of the evidence, comparison to new approach with alternatives, okay? So who's controlling the media? Well, certainly in America, there's a huge control of the media by sponsorship by the drug industry. Less so here, but it's still a major problem. Okay. You may stop and say, hold on a minute, see? Okay, fine. Media aren't reporting it correctly. You know, some of these doctors may be getting information from the media incorrectly, but we've got regulators. The regulators are gonna, you know, we should listen to them. Last night on GB News, Dan Wootton, and of course this needs to happen, we have to get responses from the regulator, went to the regulator who said, we've looked at the yellow card scheme and we can't see any link between cardiac arrest. The yellow card scheme isn't the way to look at it. It's a very interesting, carefully worded answer, by the way, from the MHRA. What's the problem? BMJ investigation done by Marion Damasi not so long ago basically showed, and in most of the funding of the many countries around the world of the regulator comes from the pharmaceutical industry. Okay, 65% of the FDA, 86% of the MHRA. Now, many doctors don't know this. I gave a talk at the BMA annual conference in a fringe meeting. The chair of the BMA was gobsmacked. He didn't believe me. This is before it was published. I said 86% of the funding of the MHRA comes from the drug industry. They didn't believe. These are people who are going on TV and saying, this has been independently evaluated, right? Most healthcare practitioners are not aware of these system failures. Next slide, please. So Donald Light, in that BMJ piece, who's a sociologist who looked at the regulator over many years and how they've evaluated different drugs, this is basically what he concludes. Can we trust the regulators? Essentially, no, according to him. It's the opposite of having a trustworthy organization independently and rigorously assessing the medicines. They're not rigorous, they're not independent, they are selective and they withhold data. Doctors and patients must appreciate how deeply and extensively drug regulators can't be trusted so long as they're captured by industry funding.
So he makes a really important point there that a lot of the industry and the persons that regulate the industry, such as the FDA and all, some of these other persons, get a lot of their funding from the pharmaceutical companies. What is sad here is because here in Bahamas, we looked to a lot of these agencies as kind of our guidance to what we should be doing. And what COVID has brought out is that a lot of these agencies are not being, they're not properly assessing a lot of this stuff because they're blinded by who's funding them. So in a sense, they're not really doing their job. And both doctors and patients and the general public needs to kind of know that, because if you're making decisions based on something that you think is going to be correct, you may not do your due diligence or research for yourself because you're really expecting those things to be, you know, in place. And if they're not in place, that's where a lot of the problems came about on how all this misinformation on COVID and stuff came out. And so many professionals were kind of going along with this because they themselves were not reading and doing the research. They really relied a lot on what was coming out from regulators. And I don't think that most of them realize how the industry has been captured over the years and been kind of, you know, slipping on the job for a very long time. And we, our eyes are basically open to that, which allows there to be some reform. And the good doctor is saying he too fell into this trap until it became a real life situation for him. So let's continue from there. Let's see if we can finish this off tonight and see if we can have time for any questions. Go on.
Right, so do we have any high quality evidence on the vaccine harms? I've told you about the benefits that we've calculated from real world data. And this is, for me, in some ways, probably a smoking gun. The original randomized control trial data, this was actually initially a preprint, now it's been peer reviewed and published in the journal Vaccine, you can look this up. Reanalyzed, so this was a number of very eminent scientists, associate editor of the BMJ, Peter Doshi, Robert Kaplan from Stanford, Joseph Freeman, who's a lead author I've also spoke to about this, and I'll tell you what he told me. What they found, they went back into the FDA's website, Health Canada website, and were able to look at reports, you know, available information, looking at serious adverse events. And what they found in the original trials, where everything is corrected, it's supposed to be the gold standard, you know, in terms of age and risk factors and everything, right, to look at the benefit of an intervention. They found the risk of serious adverse events that were reported in people in the vaccine group was significantly higher than the risk of people being hospitalized with COVID. This was the original, and this is Pfizer and Moderna trials combined. Now think about this for a second. It was these trials alone, before we had any of the data that led to the approval and rollout of the vaccine, not just a rollout, coercion, mandates, people being threatened with their jobs. My cousin in America, a civil engineer, was essentially told, unless you have a booster, you may probably lose your job, okay? This is just unbelievable. If this is true, and it's likely true, this is what the evidence is telling us. What's going on here? So we're talking about a rate of about 1 in 800 according to this. Now, has this been replicated anywhere? Yes. Norway has been very good looking at pharmacovigilance data and assessing the actual reporting of what we call the yellow card scheme over there, specifically on serious adverse events. So after two doses of Pfizer, what's documented in the real world in Norway, which have been quite good at this, looking at things that cause disability, hospitalizations, life-changing event, 1 in 926. By the way, my own view is this is likely a gross underestimate, and the reason for that is because this only covers 2 months of the trial. If the vaccine accelerates coronary artery disease, of course, that's one mechanism of harm, then you're going to see this over several months in causing problems and potentially cardiac arrests, which are not going to be picked up from the original trial. The other thing that traditionally pharmacovigilance data, I wrote about in my paper, for serious adverse events, only usually represents 10%. So what's reported is usually thought to be only 10% of the true events. By the way, I think my dad, certainly the contributing factor to his death was a vaccine. I haven't done a yellow card report. How many other people are not even aware that what's happened to Uncle Tom or one of their relatives or even themselves is linked to this? Next slide, please. Now, this is also extraordinary. The World Health Organization, before the vaccine was rolled out, approved a list of potential serious adverse effects that could happen from the mRNA vaccines based upon a number of criteria. COVID, okay, it's one of the reasons is COVID and the spike protein in serious COVID, that's one of the mechanisms that could cause harm. than technology that was being used, animal studies, and harms that have been picked up from other vaccines. Look at this list. Just stop and look at this list for a while. The cardiac complications are extraordinary. And see, the problem is, and I see this now, I remember having a conversation very recently. So I have a number of patients, by the way, with vaccine injuries, because I've looked at it and I've looked at their history, trying to figure out what's caused the problem. One of them developed, lady in her 50s, developed severe left ventricular dysfunction. And she still got that within a few weeks of having the jab. Her cardiologist, her local cardiologist, dismisses it as being impossible. Because they don't know. We didn't expect that something like this could do these things. Next slide. Now, is there a mechanism of harm? Potentially, yes. The spike protein, the lipid nanoparticles, and Claire will obviously, in the Q&A, maybe we'll talk about this as well a little bit later. It seems to be, there are evidence suggests that it gets distributed throughout the body and can stay there for 4 months. And the mechanism of harm, this is published in Cell, suggests that it can cause inflammatory reactions or direct toxicity to the cell. So we do know there is a plausible biological mechanism of how this can harm different organ systems. Now, what's going on with out-of-hospital cardiac arrest? So the heart group.
Yeah, so he talks on two very, very important points here. He talks about, because he's British, he's talking about the yellow card system, which is their way of informing if people have had any kind of side effects or complications after taking it. And they're looking at the data there and in other countries such as Norway of how many people are reporting these problems. And they're finding that it's about 1 in 800 people or so. But what he's saying is that that number is probably a lot smaller than what's happening, because even though he has investigated his own father's death and he feels that it was related, he has never officially sent that in as a case. And when you look at those systems, they're usually about tenfold below. So you want to double that number by, you want to times that number by 10, and that's usually where you are in terms of the what's actually happening. He then goes on to talk about what could it be that's actually causing these harmful effects. And it's a very interesting discussion on spike protein, because the way that these this medication, this injection works, is that it helps your body to produce the spike protein, which is the element that causes disease, we assume, in the actual virus. So if your body is producing these things and they're going around your body, and initially they said it's just in and it's out, but it's actually months and months later, they're finding evidence that spike protein is in different organs, in different places of the body. And basically they are finding it in places and it's causing inflammation, and it's this inflammation that leads to things. So if this spike protein ends up in your heart, then you have heart inflammation. If it ends up in other places, it does. In the very beginning, you know, they tried to say that it wasn't going these places, but studies in Japan have found it inside the testes, the ovaries, and young people, and all over the place. Recently, I've seen a study where it was found in breast milk, so in small quantities, and therefore they're looking at how that actually affects the micro mRNA that's produced, and whether that's going to affect children in the future. So there's a lot of sequelae that's coming out of these discoveries, and this is where he comes to his conclusion that we should just stop. So let's continue. We've got a few more minutes and see if we can get the rest of it out.
We're very good, and they've looked at, you know, ambulance data, national ambulance data. And essentially between 2021 and 2020, so after the vaccine rollout, we found there was an extra 14,000 out-of-hospital cardiac arrests are unexplained. You can see a blip here, by the way. It's important to note at the beginning of 2020 where these are calls for cardiorespiratory arrest. And this was, of course, during the first wave when a lot of people were dying at home, nursing homes. We don't have the granular data, which is what we do need, where the ambulance service will have every individual patient. What was the reason for the call? Was it COVID? Was it respiratory then caused a cardiac arrest? But that should have stopped, and it still continued well into 2021. And there was an excess. Okay, so that's one thing. It's a signal of something going on, which needs to be investigated. Next slide. Now, data from Israel, published in Nature Reports, and by the way, there has, if you look at this, there's been a warning on that. There's a discussion going on, calls for retraction of the paper. I wonder why. So these scientists found in 2021 as well, they specifically found, this is very disturbing, but in people aged between 16 and 19, there was a 25% increase in heart attack or sudden cardiac death. 25% increase. And they specifically said this was associated with the vaccine, the mRNA vaccine, not associated with COVID. Okay, so what do we know? Let's go through these now. How do we conclude, certainly with the vaccine? I'm coming towards the end, you'd be pleased to know. I know I'm going on for a while here, but there's some important information you need to know. So, what we do know for sure, what can we conclude? There's no protection from infection now, okay? That's pretty much accepted. The initial protection from the ancestral variant seems to be, in absolute terms, about 1 in 119. There was no reduction in COVID mortality or all-cause mortality from the original randomized controlled trials. The RCTs that led to the approval of the mRNA product suggest 1 in 800 vaccinees will suffer, you know, there'll be a serious adverse event. And then when you look at the number of absolute benefit of a Delta variant, the absolute benefit from over 80-year-olds is 1 in 230. From Omicron, it seems to be in the ballpark of 1 in 7,300. And, of course, you know, I don't want to go into detail on this, but if you look, the yellow card scheme reports are unprecedented. We've got about 500,000 reports beyond mild in the yellow card scheme, just purely from the Pfizer vaccine. AstraZeneca, when I went to look at this, I was shocked. I didn't know about this. The AstraZeneca vaccine, which was pulled in effect, but wasn't publicized, 1 million reports on the yellow card scheme. 1 million. I met Jeremy Hunt recently at a King's Fund meeting, and I was at in a Q&A, I was invited there, and we had a nice chat, and I said to Jeremy, I've got some information coming here. I said, I've looked at this in detail, I said, it needs to be suspended. And he said, which vaccine? I thought that was interesting. And I think he was hoping, or maybe he thought I would say AstraZeneca, because effectively it's being pulled. I said, no, Jeremy, it's the Pfizer vaccine. He said, okay, email me. So I've had some exchanges with him, and he's looking at it, but unfortunately his special advisor recently replied to me, because Jeremy was on holiday, saying, Asim, have you contacted the MHRA? Where do you go from there? And then, of course, yeah, the risk of harm seems to be, with the best quality data from my analysis, seems to be in the range of at least 1 in 1,000, okay? So we need to think about that. Okay, what's really going on here? Let's just take a step back again. I started with a broad view. I've come into the detail on the vaccine and some of the drugs. Let's go back again, because this is crucial to how we move forward, and there are solutions to this. This isn't all about doom and gloom. Let's see this as an opportunity to transform the system. So at the root of the problem are the commercial determinants of health. How do we define that? Strategies and approaches adopted by the private sector to promote products and choices that are detrimental to health. So you see these big corporations, okay, and you can include big food into this and big pharma, okay? So what happens is they have certain practices, business practices. They have a huge impact, to call this industrial epidemic, which affects obviously planetary health, population health, and increases health and social inequalities. One of the ways it does that is, of course, is that many of these big corporations don't pay their workers properly. And I know separately as a cardiologist, there's a lot of information that's going to come soon around the impact of psychosocial stress. The impact in terms of causing heart attacks is similar to being a regular smoker or having high blood pressure. And if you were a worker in a low control, low pay, high demand job, it's effectively a death sentence. And of course, companies want to pay their workers as low amount as possible, least amount possible, to generate the maximum profit. Okay, this is a really important slide, and this is very interesting. So this is a framework of how the big corporations exert their power. There are three dimensions to these, to how they exert their power. The one-dimensional view is power over decision-making and control over the political agenda. The two-dimensional view, power to define issues and potential issues. And the third one, which I think is very relevant to our discussion as well, power to avert conflict and keep conflict less.
Okay, so we're going to pause there. I want to move forward about 5 minutes. And see where that takes us, because I just want to get to the end of it so that we can have a conclusion and maybe take a call or two. So, producer, move it there and let me just kind of see where we are. Because he really went into explaining, just bringing back the entire picture of how this all comes together in a sense. And go from there.
And then you need the social movement. You need people to become enlightened. Ultimately, we have the power. We have a lot of untapped power we're not using collectively. Okay? We need, democracy is not a free ride. We must demand. We must ask those questions, demand answers from those policymakers. And of course, then political involvement. Now, some people may have different views. Smaller government, less government. No, we want better government. We want better regulation. We can't have no government. We'd have anarchy. You know, the primary purpose of government, some of the primary purpose is to protect the citizens from external aggressors and protect their populations from disease and serve the interests of their community. Our governments haven't been doing that for a long time. Because we are not having politicians that are coming from a place of real values, from a place of integrity and honesty. And of course, that's going to affect the whole culture as well. So how do we do this? Well, I've been involved over the last 10 years as a slightly controversial cardiologist. I remember being called a quack and being attacked when I said sugar was harmful to health many years ago, publishing the BMJ, when I questioned the over-medication of statins and cholesterol. So Simon Chapman was one of the successful pioneers around the tobacco control movement in Australia. And he talks about his 38-year career in public health advocacy and 10 pieces of advice for researchers and advocates. Okay, so media attention on a public health issue is often more effective than private advocacy in winning policy change. Advocacy must be evidence-based, clear, and concrete. It's very important. Speak out publicly, study the media, and be able to speak out all times. Use killer attention-grabbing facts, but place them in the context of a value system. Care about what you're advocating for. Use real people to illustrate your message. Use social media. Be patient and grow a rhinoceros hide. Because unless you're an advocate for an utterly controversial policy, as soon as your work threatens an industry or ideological cabal, you will be attacked, sometimes unrelentingly and viciously. And some of us here have experienced that. I've had that many times throughout my career. You have to have a thick skin. Next slide. And this is also crucial to where we are now. You know, medicine is not an exact science. It's an applied science. And one of the things David Sackett tells us is that 50% of what you learn in medical school, the father of the evidence-based medicine movement, will turn out to be either outdated or dead wrong within 5 years of your graduation. The trouble is nobody can tell you which half, so you have to continue to learn on your own. It means it always has to be a level of uncertainty with all this decision-making. So careers are often built on a lifetime commitment to a particular phase of evidence, but if the evidence changes, it is absolutely critical, and this is for the doctors out there and the academics, for public trust in the integrity of public health, that we acknowledge the facts have changed and accordingly we have changed our minds too. So what do we conclude overall? Certainly with the information I've got available, and we look at other vaccines that have been pulled for much less prevalence of harms. Swine flu vaccine 1976 was pulled because it caused Guillain-Barré syndrome, a neurological condition in 1 in 100,000. The rotavirus vaccine was pulled in 1999. It caused bowel obstruction in 1 in 10,000. We've got clear evidence of at least probably 1 in 800 to 1 in 1,000 of serious adverse events from these COVID mRNA vaccines. It needs to be pulled. I can't see any case to not pull it, suspend it, investigate the harms. And also, the other reassuring issue is that Omicron, what's circulating now, doesn't seem to be particularly lethal. It seems to have the same sort of infection fatality rate as a flu. So we are in a much better position that we can actually have this conversation. What should we do? How do we refocus? So we should refocus our research programs, focusing on what we call the social determinants of health. A lot of pills for chronic disease have a very marginal effect. They don't improve quality of life. I do with my own practice. It's about lifestyle. It's about diet. The research programs need to focus on those. We need to reframe our way of thinking and acting towards corporations. They are not moral beings. They are anti-human. And if we give them too much power, it's of course going to have a negative effect on society. And disconnect our research programs in terms of funding. And then we need to redesign the corporation. We need corporations. We need to redesign them through legal means. Make sure that, you know, they are making money through honest means, not through deceiving us. I love this quote from Robert Kennedy. Interestingly, I spoke to his son for the very first time yesterday, who called me and was congratulating me on the paper. So we have to think about values as well. Where do we place our values? Why are we moving away from actually what it means to be human? And Robert Kennedy, I think he picked on this beautifully. The gross national product does not allow for the health of our children, the quality of their education, or the joy of their play. It does not include the beauty of our poetry, or the strength of our marriages, the intelligence of our public debate, or the integrity of our public officials. It measures neither our wit nor our courage, neither our wisdom nor our learning, neither our compassion nor our devotion to our country. It measures everything, in short, except which makes life worthwhile.
Okay, so I'm going to end the recording there, but I think he said a mouthful, and what his conclusion was to pull the drug completely, because there's more than enough evidence that not only is it not working in the way that it should, the risk factors are high enough where it should be pulled off the market and there should be investigation, and that we need to take a look at what we're doing in medicine and the way that we're conducting medicine and move away from this really harsh pharmaceutical approach and get back into the healthy lifestyle kind of initiative and really the roots of medicine, prevention, and health. And I think that's super important. I think if we can probably take a call if someone really wants to get in here, 323-6232, 325-4316, 325-4259. The main focus of this is, in a time when we still seem to be quite behind, the world has kind of moved on in this discussion of COVID. Where are we in this conversation in the Bahamas? Why are we still encouraging children of all people, as we can see very little benefit on taking this thing? And we really just need to conclude this and to move forward from all of this. And he makes a compelling argument, very evidence-based. And that's what we need to get back to in medicine, is this kind of evidence-based approach where we need to prove things, we need to analyze, and we need to ask the important questions. If we are not questioning things, are we truly being scientists? And what we've seen is that it's almost an indoctrination in the sense of what's happened to a lot of people in both healthcare and in positions in which they could have done things a little bit differently. But for a long time, we've kind of given our power away to large organizations to determine what would be the best way to go and not questioning these guidances and guidelines. And this is really where we are. It also is concerning too for a very small country to see that, you know, within that context of not having our own research and our own kind of people to look at these things, in a sense that we can be exploited to just kind of follow along with whatever's happening in the rest of the world. You know, doctors like Asim, doctors like this one here and many others who have been talking about this, really, it opens up the fact that physicians and professionals should not be limited in their scope of discussing issues like this when it's so important. And we know that facts, evidence changes sometimes, further study needs to be made. So a consultant, a cardiologist like Dr. Asim Malhotra, who is very well known and recognized, went from being all in to basically realizing that, you know, we had made this global mistake. And it took that his father actually, he perceived, may have been injured by the fact for him to kind of change his mind. But that led him to do this form of research, to look at the numbers in detail and to provide that for us as a common good. And so, you know, it takes a lot because it's not easy. I read a lot of these papers, and if you aren't dedicated and have a good understanding of science, you really can get lost in the information, and you can get lost in the information of conclusions, because it was very popular for the last 2 years to put out a lot of information, but in order to be published, you had to come up with the conclusion that would get you published, which is a very scary thing to be in science and medicine, because that is what we call bias, and bias really destroys facts and evidence. So we have 5 more minutes, 6323-6232, 325-4316, 325-4259. We can take maybe one question, but I really wanted to go through that because as we kind of come out of all of this, there's still this sentiment that more and more people are still going to be a part of this. And the world has really moved on from that. And most of Europe has a very different view on what's happened. And I don't know why we're holding on to that. Like the cry of the minister who wants the children to be removed from the mask mandates, I also have that cry because there's misinformation that has been spread. And a lot of people think that children are the most vulnerable amongst us when it comes to COVID, when they are actually the least vulnerable amongst us. And their risk for having a serious effect with COVID is less than probably having the flu or very close. And so we should be happy about that. And we should be happy that we're moving into a more mild, like COVID flu or whatever this is. And that should be a good thing. And I know people are very fearful. People are very unsure. And a lot of people are very attached to the mask, despite all the information that's out there. And despite what is being put out there that, you know, a lot of people are very attached to the mask, despite the evidence over evidence over evidence that most of the masks that you're wearing are providing very little help at all. As I said, you probably have to wear an N95 mask consistently and perfectly, which most people do not do, in order to get any real benefit. So if you want to wear a mask, go ahead. That makes you feel comfortable. If you're someone who's high risk and you don't want to take a chance, I am not that type of person to be pushing one narrative or the other. I do believe that we all deserve the opportunity to choose. We should still be safe and do as much as we can to be safe, but the world is moving on, and those people at low risk, really, we need to move on from this, because the country is not going to do well if we continue with all of this. So there is light at the end of the tunnel. I like to also emphasize with the good doctor said, and that democracy is not a laid back event. Going to, let's say, vote or whatever every 5 years is only a small part of it. And so within all things, medicine and healthcare and politics and all of this, we as citizens have to take on the mantle of being proactive and being able to participate. And that means that you can make demands of your representatives, that you can ask questions from your healthcare provider. You should be involved in your decision-making process with anything that has to do with you and your life and things that you put inside of your body. And that's one of the main things that me, Dr. D, have been fighting for the last few years, because I know that is extremely, extremely important, that each person has a say in what happens to their personal self. So take care of yourself. Try to live a healthy life. Usually that will reduce all of the risk factors of various health diseases, including these viral illnesses. They're very connected to your health and your immunity and how well you build up that immunity. So for the future, we can't just look for today. We have to become a healthier nation. We have to look out for ourselves. We have to have good health practices in order to have a healthy future. I mean, you have to instill that inside of our children. So it seems hard, but we do need to turn all of that around. And I think we will have a bright and wonderful future as long as we get this crime under control, which is absolutely ridiculous. So I want to thank everybody for listening tonight, listening to the recording. I hope that you got all the information you need. If you need a question answered, you can drop it in the comments section online or send me a message. But I will post the entire video on my Facebook page, The Doctor's In With Me, Dr. D. So like the page, share the video, and join us next week. We got an interesting topic. We've got a guest who's coming in. We're going to talk about climate change and what's going on with that. And, you know, what are we going to do here in the Bahamas in that concern? So that should be a really interesting conversation. So join me next week, Tuesday night on Guardian Radio 96.9. Thank you. Brought to you by Medical Concierge Services. The Doctor's In With Me, Dr. D. Archer. Good night.